Registration is now live for the 15th International Conference on World War II at the National World War II Museum in New Orleans. This premier event brings together the best and brightest scholars, authors, historians, and witnesses to history from around the globe to discuss key battles, personalities, strategies, issues, and controversies of the war that changed the world. This year features a day-long pre-conference symposium, Resistance, Life Under Occupation, as well as 2 days of sessions exploring an array of topics, including the World War II's battle blunders, The Old Breed, K Company, and Eugene Sledge, Asia Aflame, Women at War, Resistance, and featuring James Holland, host of We Have Ways of Making You Talk, Richard Overy, and Ben McIntyre, and many, many more. The conference will be held November 17th to November 19th on the museum's New Orleans campus and live streamed on the museum's website. Tickets for the in-person conference are on sale now. For more information, visit conference.com. Once again, visit www.conference.com. All right, let's get back to the show.
Welcome to the American History Podcast. Hosted by Sean Morswick.
All right, so today we've got Scott Horton with us, and as you guys all know, he's been on the show several times. Scott is the author of numerous books, including Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan, and Enough Already, Time to End the War on Terrorism. He's the director of the Libertarian Institute, editorial director of antiwar.com, which I donate to and you should too, and he's the host of Antiwar Radio for Pacifica Radio's KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A., and the Scott Horton podcast. And he's done well over 5,000 interviews dating back to the early 2000s, all of which can be found at scotthorton.org in the archive section. And you can check out today's show notes page for some links to all of his books. So, Scott, welcome back.
Thanks for having me. Good to be with you.
So let's just get right into this. Last time we talked, it was late December, early January. And one of the last things I think we talked about was Ukraine and Russia. And so let's just try to catch up on what in the heck is going on over there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't remember that specific conversation, but I'm sure I told you that. No, I think that Biden is going to back down and give in enough and to avoid war here. I never said that, oh, Putin would never do that. I've been warning people that he would for a long time. He had told an Italian diplomat in 2014 that, you know, I could be in Kiev in 2 weeks and all this kind of thing. So I'd been, you know, warning that for a long time. But the thing is, his demands were essentially reasonable. And Biden seemed to be, I misinterpreted, frankly, what Biden was doing. What I thought he was doing was backing down without backing down, right? Like, they had a productive phone call on December 30th that, like, look, we're not going to bring Ukraine into NATO anytime in the next 10 years. And hey, you want to, and we have no intention of putting, missile systems into Ukraine, which I believe that Biden meant that when he said it anyway. They had betrayed no particular need to do that or want to do that. And then he had said, I forgot if it was during this conversation, but they had indicated in their counteroffer to the Russians that, we'd be happy to have inspections of our anti-missile tubes in Romania and Poland, so you can rest assured they're not Tomahawk cruise missile station in them, or, you know, positioned in them. So what I thought was happening was that Biden was telling Putin, okay, we'll back off, just don't invade. But really, no. What I was missing was that the major issue that the Russians had made clear to Biden was they weren't going to settle for any kind of just assurance. They wanted something in writing, something firm, like an amendment to the Ukrainian constitution or something like this that would guarantee that they would, become neutral, I guess, but certainly no longer even seek NATO membership, forswear NATO membership. And that the Biden government, you know, absolutely refused to even talk with them about that at all. And we know that now from Biden's guy, Derek Chollet, from the National Security Council, did an interview with War on the Rocks where he goes, oh, yeah, no, that wasn't even on the table for discussion at all. And I admit, too, that, like, I've kind of always fought the last war. I wrote this book. I'm doing, like, this endless speaking tour about the war in the Middle East and all this kind of stuff. So I wasn't paying close enough attention in December and January. And I went back and I found a lot of statements from the Biden administration and their friends, very close advisors to them, saying that essentially they do want the war, that they were willing to tell Putin, you better not. They weren't willing to really negotiate anything, you know, to the Russian satisfaction to avoid the war. They were willing to say, you better not. But really, they would say, then again, plan B, which they were obviously looking forward to, was this is an opportunity to weaken Russia. We'll do to them what we did to them in Afghanistan in the 1980s by pouring in all these weapons and weakening them. At the time, the idea was if the Russians invaded, that they would quickly win and that the Ukrainian military would be smashed and that then it would be an insurgency that we would be backing, led by these Nazi militias and so forth. Yeah. And so it turns out, you know, things turned out different than that, but that was the way they were speaking about it then. That this was their opportunity to lure the Russians into another trap, which is right along the lines of this Rand Corporation study that I believe Moon of Alabama first surfaced and talked about, called Extending Russia, as an overextending Russia. Yeah. Which is funny, right? Because it's a verb that something I'm doing to you kind of thing, right? I'm overextending you is a weird way to phrase it. But that's the goal, right? Is let's cause them so many headaches that it destabilizes their country, right? Let's, you know, and so then they go all through the list. We can try another coup in Belarus. We can pour more weapons into Ukraine. We could pour more weapons into the jihadist terrorists in the Idlib province in Syria. We could, you know, put pressure on oil prices to bankrupt their economy. We can try to separate them from, you know, by making sweetheart deals and whatever other approaches. I forget exactly about how they wanted to approach, you know, trying to break away the Central Asian stands. And, you know, especially you got to understand with Belarus, you know, for Russia, maintaining Ukraine's neutrality was essential. Was too late for that now. Yeah. That was the deal. But for Belarus, neutrality is not ever going to be good enough for the Russians. They need a loyal state there. You know, Moscow is, what, 200-300 miles from the border. And yeah, it's essentially just wide open plains. There's no rivers or mountains or anything, you know, kind of thing. And this is what's left of their buffer to their west. And they're keeping it. For the Americans to try again, they tried in 2005 with the Denim Revolution. For them to try again, they remember they did. I forget now if it was 2020 or 2021 when they did try again. Remember they publicized the wife of the guy who was trying, who had lost the election but was protesting. And I guess he'd been imprisoned. And then so they were promoting her. And so the whole purpose of this is to provoke Russia into overreacting. Now, when they talk about Ukraine in that study, and, it, you know, I bet we could find this somewhere in the future if it's not already out, that you can find a real cause and effect between this Rand Corporation study and American policy here. Like, you can just tell how they're checking off all the boxes. Maybe you could say CIA came up with the exact same thing because it was so obvious or whatever. You know, they're certainly going down this list of all these things. Now they go, look, we could overdo this and provoke Russia into invading Ukraine. And then they say that would cost them a lot of money and prestige and give us a chance to really weaken them. But then they warn in the next paragraph, hey, listen, we got to admit that would also cost us a lot and it would cost our Ukrainian friends a lot. But you know, if you actually read the long, like 200-page version of that study, you know, there's the PDF, there's like the short version, but there's the long version, like almost a book-length kind of study of this. And when you read that, it's like bad advice with a little bit of like, then again, and then bad advice, and then, you know, you would also be risking, and then bad advice, and then a little bit of like, well, how about some wiggle room? But then if you look at the policy, where's the wiggle room? They're going full bore, like they didn't take into account any of the warnings, right?
Chuck.
But then to see that the way that they think, you know, if we overdid it and provoked Russia into invading Ukraine,
That actually would be beneficial to us in numerous ways. On the other hand, it would also be, you know, this is going to get out at some point. And so we want to also warn that don't lock us up for this. So, you know, that's clearly the policy. And then I'll refer you to Admiral Stavridis. I'm still making excuses for my last failure of an appearance on your show. Admiral Stavridis, who would have been Hillary Clinton's Secretary of Defense. And then Hillary Clinton, very shortly after him, she went on MSNBC, but he told this to the New York Times. He says, listen, and he uses the exact same language as the Rand Corporation study. We're pouring in all these weapons. We have to carefully calibrate how many weapons we pour in. And this is just what the Rand Corporation says, that we want to, you know, give the Russians a headache, bog down their special operations forces, make them spend a bunch of money, make them waste a bunch of, like, you know, political capital on the international stage by backing these separatist forces in the East and this kind of thing. I mean, geez, you don't want to, you know, overdo it and provoke them into invading. So Stavridis says the same thing to the New York Times. We want to carefully calibrate the amount of arms we're putting in to deter Putin from invading without provoking him into invading. And then I'm virtually certain now off the top of my head that it's the same article where Stavridis says, you know, then again, if they invade, then we can do our Afghanistan thing too. And he says, it's so shameless, these people. He goes, listen, we don't know the first thing about defeating an insurgency. I admit that right after 20 years of promising that, you know, there's light at the end of the tunnel and all of this. Okay. 4 months after the end of America's ignominious retreat and humiliating defeat and withdrawal from Afghanistan.
Here we are.
He's got Afghanistan in his mouth and he's saying, we don't know how to defeat an insurgency, but we sure know how to back one like we did in Afghanistan in the 1980s, which for people who know, led to our 20-year war, right?
That's right.
I mean, this is some pretty clear cause and effect. I wrote a book about it. You can check it out.
And, it's a good book, too.
Yeah, thanks. But so for them to just be like, yeah, that's what we could do again, just like in Rambo 3, and pretend like the last 35 years of history didn't happen. There's nothing to regret or worry about the results of that policy then.
What could go wrong?
Yep. I'm sorry, Bill Kaufman, what?
I mean, what could possibly go wrong, right?
Oh. Yeah,
we're just going to put all these weapons into Ukraine.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I just it's not like Afghanistan blew up in our face or anything like that. No.
And then he said Syria. He goes, yeah, we did the same thing in Syria. But okay, so let's say that you don't remember Afghanistan because that was the 80s and that was a long time ago and maybe you were too young. But don't we all remember that Obama's dirty war in Syria led directly to the rise of the Islamic State Caliphate that conquered all of eastern Syria and all of western Iraq for 3 years and led to Iraq War III and another 500,000 people killed in this absolute catastrophe? And they go, and this is just, you know, less than 10 years later, what is just, hell, 5 years later, he's saying, yeah, man, that's what we want to do to Ukraine, what Obama did to Syria. What Ronald Reagan and Jimmy Carter before him did to Afghanistan. Are you people mad? They're mad. And so anyway, that's why I'm an idiot, is because I wasn't reading the New York Times close enough in the month of January, or I'd have seen that. And I said, oh, my God. And I did see Biden's readout of his call with Putin on the 30th of December. And I thought, you know what? That's not so bad. It sounds like they're backing down. And I really did not read that right. I should have read that much more like Biden is being absolutely intransigent here when he should be giving in. And so there goes the war. And look, that's not to absolve Putin in any way for anybody listening. Don't get me wrong, because he's a son of a bitch and he didn't have to do this. But the reality is they're lying that it's an unprovoked war. They provoked it. And in fact, the war itself has been going on since the year 2014, 8 years ago, when Joe Biden was the point man in the Obama administration, when they overthrew the government in February 2014, and which led immediately to a war against the secessionists in the East who refused to recognize the authority of the new coup junta that had overthrown their democratically elected president. And then the new president declared a war on terrorism and attacked them. And you know, there's some like 14,000 people were killed over the last 8 years, I believe, about what, like 8 or 10 of those in the first 2 years. And then still a couple thousand more in the so-called low-level fighting, kind of artillery exchanges back and forth over this time. And the UN statistics show that 80% of the civilian casualties are on the Donbass side, you know, on the separatist side being inflicted by the Ukrainian government. So again, that's not to absolve Putin, because what did he do? He escalated the entire conflict by 100,000 times. So pardon my language, but F him, you know, I'm not saying that, but I'm just saying that was not the first day of history on February the 23rd, 24th, when he rolled his guys in there, man. This was, you know, a war that had been ongoing that he then escalated massively in the way that he has. And so, and it is a catastrophe, and tens of thousands of people have been killed. And he and his American counterparts and equals here have humanity on essentially, I mean, I wasn't alive then. But it's absolutely within the margin of error if you want to try to quantify it, as far as how close we are to nuclear war compared to 1962 and the height of the Cuban Missile Crisis, when Jack Kennedy was telling the Soviets, you get those missiles out of Cuba or else, and I'm not asking you, I'm telling you. And then they did negotiate a way out of it. But I mean, for people who don't know that history, you know, Soviets were putting these missiles into Cuba. And Jack Kennedy was absolutely hardline. He had provoked the thing by putting the missiles in Turkey in the first place. But he was absolutely hardline about it. And, you know, the way that they put it at the time was that was the absolute brink of full-scale general thermonuclear war between America and the Soviet Union. And that, in other words, by the, when they say the absolute brink, they mean one hair more and that's it.
That's
there,
right.
There is no further without them cooking off. And then at that point, we're talking about megaton bombs, one of which can kill your whole city.
That's right. So
that's it. I mean, these are, you know, if I mean, the Nagasaki bomb killed 75,000 people and then more with the radiation later. But the Nagasaki bomb is a blasting cap that you use to set off a modern thermonuclear bomb. You have to make it that hot with an A-bomb to be able to cause the fusion that allows the H-bomb to be detonated. Otherwise, you know, they say cold fusion, that's like the panacea, free energy forever. The only way to get fusion done under current technological circumstances is you got to make it hotter than the sun in order to get the fusion to work. So you make it hotter than the sun first by splitting a plutonium isotope atom and releasing that heat energy. Now it's hot enough to fuse hydrogen atoms together. Now you're talking about killing all of New York City with one bomb. All of Dallas, all of Houston. I mean, for people who traveled to these megalopolises, you ever flown into Los Angeles at night? You're talking about you could kill all of that with one big bomb from Long Beach to Santa Barbara, or, you know, Encinitas. I guess the mountains intervene there somewhere. But one good bomb, take out the entire L.A. basin there, make it uninhabitable forever, kill, you know, 10 million people in a shot.
Yep.
Something. I mean, I'm making those numbers up. What the hell do I know? But they're, I mean,
It's scary.
Megatons, you know, over like, you know, East Hollywood kind of area, like central Los Angeles sort of area, like right around the 10 and the 110 or whatever. From the ocean to downtown would be gone.
That's right.
You know?
That's right. It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. Now, that brings me to Putin, I guess. Just had a speech about a week ago now. We're recording this on Friday. What is this? The 7th of October. So just a week ago, Putin had a speech, and there's a lot that he said. I don't want to get into everything that he said. But I mean, he did say that, you know, people are saying that he wants to create the Soviet Union, recreate it is what's one of the accusations. But I mean, he says, and this is a direct quote, there is no Soviet Union. The past cannot be brought back. And Russia today does not need it anymore. We're not striving for this. So what, you know, what is it? What's his end game, I guess, is what I'm getting at.
Man, you know, Dave Smith has done such a great job lately of making this comparison with bin Laden. Everybody agrees this guy's a cold-blooded murderer. That's not in question. You can discuss these men and be descriptive without being normative. You know, I can understand David Koresh and tell you he was not Charles Manson. He was something else. Doesn't make him my best buddy. Doesn't make him my minister. Doesn't make me his greatest champion. Just makes me the champion of the truth about this guy, that he was this. It doesn't mean he was that. So what they say about bin Laden, he hates you because you love your mom and Jesus Christ. Well, what a damn lie that is. That is a damn lie. He wanted to knock those towers down because of the people Bill Clinton killed. Period. That's what it was all about. America's tyranny in the Middle East was what it was all about. So does that absolve a guy who targets civilians for cold-blooded murder to make his point, to provoke the overreaction he was trying to provoke? Of course not. Would have done us well to understand what was going on, not just his motive, but his strategy too. Because what did he want? He wanted, as his son later put it, for America to act like the big dumb bull who chases after the red scarf. That's so right. One, he doesn't hate you for your mama. And two, going big isn't the solution. Yeah. That's the problem that caused the problem in the first place, right? So we got that whole era, 20 years. I wrote a book about it, enough already. 20 years of the entire terror war, all wrong, should have never happened, none of it. And in fact, I'm sorry, I got to mention W. Bush in his recent Freudian slip. You heard him referring to Putin. He said the unnecessary and unprovoked invasion of Iraq, which was an accident, and you could say, ha ha, you're subconscious, but that's not a real tangible thing, and it's still debatable. But here's what's important, is after he said that, and everybody laughed, he said, Iraq too. Okay? He wasn't accusing Putin of invading Iraq. Iraq too what? He's saying Iraq was also an unnecessary and unprovoked invasion.
That's right.
Right. In other words, the man himself finally said he should not have kicked over the entire Middle East, not just Iraq War II, but led immediately on to Libya, to Syria, of course, his own war in Somalia, but then on to his absolutely horrible war in Afghanistan that Obama then tripled and lost anyway, the horrible war in Yemen. All of this is due to his choice to go to Baghdad, his absolutely unforced error that he did for his own selfish reasons. It's just absolutely despicable. And that's out of the mouth of the man himself. He accidentally admitted it, and then he went, yeah, I admit it. Okay? So that means I'm right. Right? Yeah. That means this whole thing didn't have to happen. Now, if we'd been honest, look, I know you were upset. I was upset too. Everybody was upset. That doesn't mean, like, look, I mean, seriously, what are we, children? Drink some brandy. Now turn your crybaby off and let's think about what we're doing here and be smart and tough.
That's right.
Why would Bin Laden do this? Because he wanted us to turn around and run away like little girly men? No, it was because he was trying to bait us into committing suicide, say murder suicide, bogging ourselves down, bleeding us to bankruptcy on the Reagan Afghan model from the 1980s. But, you know, the same policy that the Carter and Reagan administration inflicted on the Soviet Union with using bin Laden and his men as some of the instruments in that policy in the 1980s was the same policy bin Laden adopted against us. The same policy that Hillary Clinton and Admiral Srivridis and these guys are openly proclaiming is the same one that they want to replicate again. They think, to shorten it one step, that bin Laden's really onto something here. That what he did to us by baiting us into a giant, stupid, horrible no-win war was really smart. And we want to forget Ronald Reagan. Our government wants to replicate bin Laden against the Russians. And it was bin Laden the first time, too. He was wounded 3 times in that war. He was part of the Azam group that was one of the most effective groups of the Arab Afghan army that fought as the auxiliaries in that war. Same guys again. Okay? Now, so... But that's even just a metaphor. I'm just setting up to say that, like, look, again, everyone agrees Osama bin Laden was a horrible murderer. But the question was, what was he doing and what were we doing about it? And everybody got all that wrong because you weren't allowed to be honest about who he was and what he was doing. And they would falsely, obviously, stupidly accuse you of taking his side. Like, look, if we were in a war with the English or the Japanese, I guess you could say, like, there are some people going to choose England's side or the Japanese side or something like that. There's no constituency for Osama bin Laden in the United States of America, not on the radical left or anywhere else. Nobody identifies with this guy and his agenda. No libertarian certainly does. Same thing with Vladimir Putin. What does Vladimir Putin have that we don't already have here? He's a conservative, Christian, corrupt, corporate Republican. We got those. right? He would fit right in with the Republican Party, the same one we've had for 50 years, right? No question about that. No problem at all. So why would any Americans need to look to Moscow to have somebody to be loyal to, right? Now, don't get me wrong, this is completely stupid, but it's true that there were Americans who were dedicated to Soviet communism who believe with religious fervor in the government of the Soviet Union as the savior of mankind and all this crap. Maybe millions of them. I don't know. Not very many millions, but a couple or something. I don't know. Hundreds of thousands. But there's just nothing like that about red, white, and blue Republican Russia today. It's just not true. If somebody said that, like, oh, yeah, no, you're telling the other side of the story because you're loyalty to Russia, that ought to sound to you as just obviously completely stupid, right? As actually a cowardly cop-out from someone who's afraid to deal with the reality of the situation. You know, when that's Putin was saying things for, you know, decades straight about, you know, W. Bush, you shouldn't have tore up that anti-ballistic missile treaty and started to put these dual-use missile launchers in Poland that you could use to shoot nuclear-tipped Tomahawk missiles at us. You can't just pretend that didn't happen, that he didn't say that over and over and over again for the last 15 years, that his foreign minister didn't say these are the brightest of red lines. You can't talk about bringing Ukraine into NATO. You can't arm up Ukraine. And Putin's declaration of war on the 22nd, 23rd. Pardon me. Hmm? Oh, sorry.
No.
Let me get a drink here.
Go ahead.
Sorry. On the speech that he gave in his declarations of war, they were essentially perfectly rational cases for war. Now, I'm not saying reasonable ones, as in good enough for me as an excuse to do what he did. I'm just saying these aren't like the ravings of a madman. He's clearly angry, but the case that he makes is a solid case. And essentially what he says, and people ought to be able to understand this, if you have a picture of Eastern Europe in your head at all, he says, listen, first of all, the communists, Lenin and Stalin, Trotsky, Stalin, whichever it was, but Lenin, he drew the lines of the modern nation state of Ukraine back then. Mm-hmm. And as he put it, weirdly included the Donbass in there. Now, it wasn't weird. It was, you know, an attempt to dominate Ukrainian culture with Russian culture. By including, you know, part of Russia. And in fact, they even, under Stalin, exported Ukrainians out of there and moved Russian speakers in. And of course, outlawed Ukrainian as a language, tried to force everyone to speak Russian and Russianize the place under the guise of Soviet communism. Of course, there's the Holodomor horrible genocide of the 1930s, as people know. So a lot of this is absolutely a consequence of the sins of the Soviet communists from 100 years ago, right? Mm-hmm. Then he says, the other crazy thing the commies did was Khrushchev gave away Crimea to Ukraine. And he did that because you got to understand, he just needed political support. This is gamesmanship and, you know, palace intrigue so that he can succeed Stalin as the dictator after Stalin died. And he needed the support of the Ukrainian Communist Party. Didn't make any difference because they were all unanswerable to Moscow anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yes, who cares?
But yeah, so this, after the Soviet Union fell apart, this left Crimea in this odd place. But the compromise was the Ukrainians can keep it, but the Russians get to keep their naval base there. It'll stay a Ukrainian sovereignty, and the Russians will lease the base. And so that that compromise had held for 24 years from the, you know, fall of the Soviet Union. You know, 1991 was the last day, it was Christmas Day 91, and it held all the way through 2014 when the situation changed in the aftermath of the Barack Obama, Joe Biden coup of 2014. Which we can get back to that in a second. But and then he says, and then the third thing that the Soviet communists did was Gorbachev, on his way out, the last dictator of the USSR in 1991, he gave them full independence. When, according to Putin, geez, he didn't have to do that. You could have kept Belarus and Ukraine, at least, you know, this kind of idea. And to tell you the God's honest truth, that's what H.W. Bush wanted. He for the USSR to stay together under Moscow's rule, at least Belarus and Ukraine at that time. We're terrified of what was going to happen after that. For right or wrong reasons, that was the call they made at the time. Again, this is descriptive, not normative. I'm just saying, you know.
And that's that so-called Chicken Kiev speech that was written, right, ironically enough, by Condoleezza Rice.
That's right. And he's warning, he's telling in that Chicken Kiev speech, he's telling them, you can get the audio too. He says, and the video's on YouTube. Mm-hmm. He says, listen, if you guys are going to get independence, it's going to be on Moscow's timetable, not yours. And he's essentially warning them, I won't stand behind you in war. If you pick a fight with Moscow and they attack you, I'm not coming to save you. Now, at that time, man, that was so late date. That was August of 91. He should have known. They declared independence a few weeks later, I think, anyway, and the Russians didn't do anything about it. And the whole thing was over by Christmas, right? So it was embarrassing in hindsight. But then, importantly, he warns, we will not support the replacement of a far-off tyranny with a local despotism. He warns against the ferocities of ethnic hatred and all of this danger. And what he's talking about, look, he's a former CIA director. He knows good and well the history of the CIA backing the remnants of the Nazi forces from World War II during the Cold War against the Soviet communists. So he knows that there are very radical right-wing dangerous forces here that if they were to seize all the power could, try to get America into a war. And he wanted to make it very clear to them that I don't have your back if you guys are going to pick one of these fights in anything but the spirit of democracy and liberty that we're trying to, in other words, compliance with American goals and systems that we're trying to push here at that time. But so but the point being here on independence, that Putin says essentially, well, whatever, man, like there was a whole Yeltsin between Gorby and me. Nothing I can do about that. I'm very loosely paraphrasing here. That's the reality we live in. But then he says, but the Americans wouldn't let Ukraine be independent. You got to run off with them. You got to take them. You got to dominate. He goes, look at the government in Kiev right now as an American colony. Fact. I mean, if there's a way to quantify that, then it's a scientific proof. It's true, right? Like if it's a quality, then what can you say? Yeah, have to agree. But if it's a quantity, then it's like, yeah, up is up and down is down. The government of Kiev is an American satrapy. That's what it is. It's a sock puppet, not exactly dictatorship, but sure as hell is not a Ukrainian democracy in any sense. It's dictated to, controlled by Washington, D.C. in every way. State and CIA and the Treasury and the rest. And he goes, so then Putin says, listen, if after these three major errors of our Soviet communist predecessors, and now we're stuck in this situation where America is determined to refuse to allow Ukraine to remain neutral, then F you, I'm going to take it. If it can't be neutral, then it's going to be Russian dominated, not American dominated. And the fact is, I mean, that's just no different than if I go to your place and I just start pushing you and slapping you and putting you up against the wall. Like at some point, you're going to knock my block off, man. You know, that's worse when it's me going, hey, let's you and him fight. Right. And now I'm pushing you toward a guy who's twice as big as you. Yeah. Going, yeah, you can take him. Don't worry. I got your back. Right. You can trust me.
Until push comes to shove.
Yeah, it's absolutely wrong, right? And look, and it comes down to it. What if America lived up to our obligation? What does that mean? And we're willing to go to H-bomb war over a country that's east of Eastern Europe? You know, Austria was neutral in the Cold War. Well, you got Slovakia and Ukraine between the Donbass, right? We're talking about like 900 miles east of what used to be neutral territory.
As Pat Buchanan says, the Elbe River was the drawing line.
Right.
Well, the most belligerent of Cold War presidents, if you want to say it's Eisenhower or Truman or Reagan, whomever, would never have thought about putting American lives at stake over, no offense to any Ukrainians listening, but we weren't going to go to war over, Kiev.
Yeah, look, because this isn't personal. It's not a question of like how much do you value Ukrainian life or any of that. Again, if the Biden government cared about these people at all, they wouldn't have got them into this mess. And
that's right.
By the way, we know too, and I always neglect to really emphasize this first and foremost, that we know from very detailed reporting from Ukrainian Pravda, and that's not the Russian sock puppets, that's very pro-Ukrainian nationalist
reporting there in Ukrainian Pravda, and now absolutely confirmed by one of the high priestesses of the American War Party, Fiona Hill, in Foreign Affairs magazine, the highest ranking, most important journal of the American foreign policy establishment, that they had a peace deal in March. And then America sent Boris Johnson to ruin it. And Boris Johnson himself confirmed this in a manner of speaking, but you know what he meant, absolutely. And we know from the rest of this reporting, essentially, he's confirming it. And you can read it, and it's in a readout of a phone call between him and the president of France that he posted on his own website. And then I told the president of France that I had told the president of Ukraine, you better not make this deal if you know what's good for you, et cetera. You know, it's all in there. So, so we could have had a deal a long time ago, tens of thousands of people ago. And the deal was that the Russians would pull all the way back to where they were on the 23rd, which is just when they're barely making entry in the very easternmost part of the Donbass. And, you know, just, I don't know if this is 100% fact, but it was seemingly credibly reported by Russian media that a few years ago, I forgot the date, I'm sorry, maybe 2015, you know, at the end of the worst part of the war there, that the President Poroshenko had said to Vladimir Putin, look, man, just you take the Donbass, because they had declared independence and had petitioned to join Russia. And he had told them no.
Yeah, he didn't want it.
So here's the president of Ukraine goes, you just take them. And Putin says, I don't want them. Are you kidding me? Don't come at me with this. You just make peace with them and live up to the deal. So even if the story is not exactly true, that that conversation happened, in a sense, like if you don't buy that, it's still meaningful that that was the narrative the Russians were putting out at the time. They're like, look, man, we don't want it.
You and just step that you know, this dictator and this narrative is getting put out, then it, even if he's not saying it, he's kind of saying it. So it's coming from his lackeys at the very least.
Right. Oh, and which goes back to your question, which I sort of spaced out, which is this is all from, you know, psychopath Putin's grand megalomaniacal, obsession of recreating the USSR or at the very least the old Tsarist Empire. And he has complained about Russian speakers who were left behind in Latvia and Lithuania. As well as in Kazakhstan, there are a lot of Russian speakers who, you know, during the Soviet Union, they sort of colonized out into the buffer areas that Stalin had conquered during the Second World War, especially. And then, well, and even before that, I guess the Baltics had been taken already. Now the deal is like in the Baltic states, there was like some slight repression of Russian speakers there for a while. And then I think Putin had kind of barked and said, I really don't like that. And then they knocked it off. Like it was a little bit of discrimination in the use of the Russian language or something, just a little bit of not too bad. And we're going back 10 years now or something like that. But essentially, you do not have anything like a human rights crisis affecting the Russian speakers of the Baltic states, right? They're minorities, and maybe they're not the highest caste or whatever, but they're not in trouble, and they don't need saving, and nobody's even pretending that they do. Yeah. Here in this case, Putin sends deniable special operations forces across to help, you know, to defend them for a long time, but refused to do what he's now done, which is say, oh, yeah, this is Russian territory now. Now I dare you to attack it and annex it, which is what he's done only now in the last week, as we're discussing this in October of 2022, right? Eight years after the fact. And, you know, why did he tell them no then? When they were asking to join Russia then, he said no because why? Because he had the Minsk II peace deals that were brokered by our German and French allies that the Obama government rubber stamped as accepting and agreeing to, that the UN had as well. That said, we're going to have peace. We're going to have a ceasefire. We're going to rebuild the East. We're going to essentially grant the Donbass statehood, like strong federalism, but they're going to remain within Ukraine. And that was the deal as it was supposed to be. Now, as this war broke out, it was 7.5 years, or I'm sorry, from because it was Minsk II was like February of 15. So 7 years after the peace deal did not take. It's 8 years after the coup that started the war in the first place, and Putin was drawing his line in the sand, and again, the Americans were provoking him. So
now, you know, back to the bin Laden comparison, this whole thing about, well, this guy just wants to conquer a lot and rebuild the empire. Even his most grandiose statements, sort of like bin Laden, yes, talked about religion a lot, but still, don't get your cart and horse mixed up yeah. here about what's going on. You know what I mean? So Putin's talking about, yeah, we got to save these Russian speakers. But save them from what? Like imagined threats? He's not invading Lithuania over imagined threats to Russian speakers in Lithuania. He is invading Ukraine over very real threats to their lives. You know, again, 14,000 people killed in the fighting over the 7 years there.
That's right.
So that is, you know, if bin Laden had his list of grievances, which, by the way, again, to specify, was American bases in Saudi Arabia used to bomb Iraq for all, you know, 10 years through H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton in the run up to Iraq War II and September 11th. Support for the Israelis, support for dictators in the region, pressure on them to keep their oil prices artificially low to subsidize our economy at their expense, and blind eye turned to Russia, China, and India and their wars against Muslims, which is not entirely true. America backed the Mujahideen against China and Russia in Xinjiang and in Chechnya. I don't know about the Indians so much, but anyway. And Kazakhstan was one of his complaints. Anyway, so those were bin Laden's grievances, support for Israel and the bases in Saudi to bomb Iraq from, for, you know, most of all. And so you want to make the comparison then. So this is Putin's grievances. We're expanding NATO right into his sphere of influence. We're arming up enemy states. We're, if they vote wrong, we'll overthrow their government. We're just all these color-coded revolutions. We're installing anti-missile missiles in launch tubes that can be used for offensive Tomahawk H-bomb cruise missiles, which they can be equipped with H-bombs and have, you know, 20-minute, 30-minute flight times from Moscow. And totally, you know, the Russians, I think, did violate the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, but America violated it in spirit first with those launchers, you know, Aegis on shore, as they put it. But those launchers can be used for Tomahawk cruise missiles, and that was a huge complaint. That was before the Russians started making mid-range missiles and before Donald Trump then tore up the INF treaty back a couple years ago. So anyway, this is all just like with bin Laden. It's not to in any way justify what they're doing. It's just saying if you had a provocation, if you had a policy of how to provoke these guys into attacking us, this is what it would be. And I'm not saying that in a conspiratorial way. I'm just, well, actually, I sort of am in the case of Russia here. They seemingly really did provoke them. I don't know. I actually used to think in the 90s before September 11th that I don't know if bin Laden really works for the CIA, but they seem to be deliberately provoking him. But then, you know, I don't know, man. But point is, they're going to take advantage of all this stuff no matter what. It isn't fair to the American people that we're supposed to just have to swallow that. Well, the thing is, the bad guy that we're dealing with here, he's bad. And so he does these bad things. And us, we're the good guys. So we have to go do good things against the bad guy. And we're just supposed to sit here and take this like we're all in the second grade. And it just ain't right. And everyone knows. Everyone knows. America is the world empire. The Soviet Union collapsed 30 years ago. Nothing replaced it. There's one lone superpower, us, not China, not Russia, not the European Union, the United States of America. There is a one world government. It's called the Pentagon.
Yeah,
and
that's right.
So,
that's right.
You know, how can we think that the New World Order means they're coming for us? The New World Order is us coming for everybody else. And absolutely refusing to accept their independence from our rule, like we're the British. And look at what we've given up, anything like a constitutional republic built for the purpose of protecting our lives and liberty in the name of protecting supposedly freedom for everybody else in the world, when that's never the result of the policy. It's nothing but death and destruction and economic dislocation and destabilization and grief. I mean, you know, not to be too damn sentimental about this, but I think people need reminding about this kind of thing from time to time a little bit, and not by like some cynical demonstration. I don't mean it like that, but I'm just saying, you know, think about how sad you are if your auntie dies of cancer at 78 or whatever, right? Hang on, yeah. Man, I had an auntie die. It was really hard. I loved her very much. Like, if someone had exploded her to death, I just don't know what I would do. You know, and like, and we're not talking like a criminal. We're talking like a foreign government with absolute impunity.
Yeah.
Comes and blows her up with a drone in her hometown or sends in the 3rd Infantry Division with their artillery because they say there's an enemy around here they're hunting for or some kind of thing. And I got to deal with, you know, look, just put the shoe on the other foot for a minute. You know, a child, I won't pick a child that, you know, with their arms and legs blown off and then they bleed out, but they have a couple of minutes to scream and cry about how bad it hurts on the way out. And you got to hear it. That's what we do to these people.
Yeah.
We explode them to death.
Yep.
Yep. Tear them apart. And people act like, you know, it's like an old Western where the guy takes a bullet in the chest. He just covers the hole in his chest. There's no blood. And he goes, ah, and he falls and dies.
Yeah,
and that's it. He doesn't even scream out for his mama one time. He's just done.
Doesn't work that way.
No. And so, you know, this is beyond a horror movie, anything.
That's right.
The kind of reality that we're bringing to these people. And look, people want to go, and I'm not a ideological pacifist. I'm not a religious guy. You know, I am for defensive violence. If absolutely necessary, someone's breaking in your, climbing in your window at night or, robbing your store or whatever kind of thing. People got to do what they got to do. A foreign nation is attacking our nation. And we got all like, I don't know, grab rifles and run toward the shore in our Toyota Helixes and take their asses on. Like, fine, sign me up, man. But that's not what we're talking about.
Exactly.
And, you know, I'm rambling, but, you know, the doctrine is that, like, yeah, but, you know, we're holding the whole world down because if we didn't, it would all unravel. But I just don't see the evidence of that. And I think there's, you know, maybe you could argue that is true in some cases, but it doesn't mean it's the only option. You could just have honest diplomacy instead. But I definitely see many cases where you have bullies of the world who are backed by the United States who are absolutely worse because they are backed by the United States. Say, for example, Israel and Saudi Arabia. And you just look at what happens when Biden even began to imply he was backing off our support for the Saudis. They immediately sent their ambassadors to Baghdad to meet with the Iranians on neutral ground. Friends again, guys. Now, the story is, no, if we leave, they'll all go to war against each other. But no. It was W. Bush who restarted all this sectarian civil war stuff in 2003. People go, oh, they've been fighting for centuries. Well, I don't know. Nuh-uh. And there wasn't a war going on until we started it.
That's right.
Saddam didn't invade Iran until Jimmy Carter asked him to do it.
That's right.
So what are we talking about? You know, Americans got to take some responsibility for this stuff.
We never do.
That's right. And that's why it continues on. That's why they're able to continue to say, look, mistakes were made, but we're moving on to the next big project. You know, I swear, I hope I found, I mean, I saved these quotes for the next book. I'm pretty sure I did. I know I can find it again. Where I'm 99% it was the New York Times, where the Obama people are saying, yeah, see, this is our redemption for the last 20 years of failed interventions in the Middle East. Iraq and Afghanistan, man, those really were bad. But see, now this proves we really are the good guys. We really are. Remember that time we saved France from the Nazis? Remember that time that Christopher Reeve, the virgin Boy Scout Superman, saved the little white cat from the tree? That's the real us. And this is our chance to act that way again by pouring arms into Ukraine for a civil proxy war right on their eastern, on Russia's western border, led by a bunch of Hitler-loving Nazis at the front. Huh?
Yeah. It's,
but they, you see how bad they need to believe in themselves here? That, like, no, we're just the Eagle Scouts, man. We're just Mighty Mouse come to save the day. That's it. You know?
We're Luke Skywalker, and we're the Rebel Alliance and Putin's Vader or something, you know? It's like, crazy.
He hates us because we're free. He hates us because of our innocence. He saw our weakness and took advantage. Right. I remember on September 12th or 13th, 2001, the TV lady said, she's just parroting what some cop said or whatever.
Yeah.
Oh, these terrorists, they've awakened a sleeping giant. And it's like, dumb hairdo lady, the giant ain't been asleep since 1941 when the Japanese came and awakened it. That was it. Right. I mean, don't pretend for a moment otherwise that America was asleep. Oh, yeah. There's Jonah Goldberg's lies in the National Review. Yeah. Turning away from the world and refusing to intervene sure does have its consequences. Yeah. Damn lies. You know, and of course the prescription was, so now we got to double triple down. So all we can do is make it worse. We have to.
I've had people who tell me, you know, well, in the 90s, you know, we didn't do this or that. And I'm like, man, I was in the Navy. I was in the Middle East in the 90s. We were bombing them. What are you talking about?
Yeah.
Like there was no time when we weren't doing that.
Yeah. I can't remember who started it. We had a fun little conversation. I don't take all the credit, but just a little about, I don't even think I take a little. Somebody else said this and it was funny. And it was about how did Tom Cruise cause September 11th? Because in Top Gun, right? Like that whole era, that whole thing, he would have been the commander of that naval squad. He would have led naval forces against Iraq in Iraq War I. And then it would have been him and Iceman and their group would have been the ones flying Navy sorties from those carriers to patrol the no-fly zones over Iraq throughout the 1990s and killing those people and provoking that war. It was really Air Force, I guess, on the ground in Saudi, and then but the Navy flying those sorties the whole time as well from ships in the Persian Gulf. And that so it would have been Top Gun. Those were the guys who caused the war. Oh, I know what it was. It was somebody wrote, I don't remember who it was, but somebody had wrote about in the new movie. They go, yeah, he was in Iraq and Afghanistan. And they were like, huh, well, wait, which Iraq? Oh, no, they go, oh, he was in Iraq both times. And they go, well, which both? Because there was three Iraq wars. So you're saying he was in, you know, because the ISIS war is Iraq War III, right, against the caliphate.
Yeah.
So so which two are they referring to there? And then they're like, well, wait a minute. If he had done Iraq War I and Iraq War II, then he probably caused September 11th that became the excuse for Iraq War II. Thanks a lot, Tom Cruise.
It's all Maverick's fault.
Absolutely, man. Him and Val Kilmer. Although I did learn from Val Kilmer how to flip my pen around like this in 1985.
I could never do that. That's pretty good. I like that.
Iceman. I've been like this ever since then.
All right. Well, Scott, thank you so much. We've run out of time today. I appreciate you coming on and trying to catch us up a little bit on Russia and Ukraine and all the disaster that's going on over there. Hopefully, if we get you on again, it'll be something else and this will be solved. Hopefully, there will be another time and we don't all just get combusted in nuclear Armageddon.
That's what I think, not. Too. Yeah. Let's avoid that if we can.
Thank you very much. And for those of you listening, we will have links in the show notes page to Scott's books. I suggest you check them out. Christmas time is coming, and those will make some great gifts for the history buffs in your family. So thank you guys once again, and we'll see you all next time.
Do you like the sound of the American History Podcast? My audio production is provided by the Mad Octopus. Check them out over at madoctopusmedia.com.